This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It practically doesn't matter where you are in the country this summer. All of us can agree it is hot. Today it's our turn on the East Coast. Temperatures are expected to reach triple digits in New York, Connecticut, Philadelphia, here in Washington, D.C., and at a lot of points in between. A cold front just pushed the miserable weather out of much of the Midwest, and there has been some relief from record temperatures on the West Coast as well. Just about everywhere, the heat wave put unprecedented stress on power grids. Yesterday's all-time record electrical demand in the mid-Atlantic states is likely to fall today. There have been some localized blackouts. A sizable section of Queens in New York City was out for 10 days last month, and an outage in Chicago prompted authorities to evacuate some buildings yesterday. California escaped the rolling blackouts of 5 years ago, though not by much. 3 years ago, much of the Northeast and parts of the Midwest went dark. At the time, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson described the U.S. as a first-world country with a third-world power grid. So how much has changed since then? Is the grid keeping up with increased demand, and what more could be done? Later in the program, political junkie Ken Rudin returns, and Senator Joe Lieberman joins us to talk about next week's primary in Connecticut for the Democratic nomination for Senate. If you have questions about that election or other political news of the week, you can send us email now. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, the power grid. How is it holding up where you live? What about new construction, conservation, and what about prices? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And we begin with Greg Fishman, a spokesman for the California Independent System Operator. He's with us now from the studios of member station KXJZ in Sacramento, California. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you, Neil. It's a pleasure to join you.
In retrospect, how close did you guys come to rolling blackouts?
Well, we were at a stage two emergency one day last week, Monday the 24th, when we set a new record for California energy usage. But really, we still had a little bit of additional breathing room. The stage two emergency that we called lets us access some commercial and industrial energy users, large companies typically, that will reduce their energy demand at key times under emergency conditions. And in exchange, they get a reduced rate from their local utility. There's approximately 1,800 megawatts or so in that program, actually those programs. There's more than one. Mm-hmm. And we accessed that about halfway. We got about 855 megawatts worth of load reduction for a couple of hours on that afternoon, and that was enough to bring our reserve levels back up to acceptable levels.
So close, but not all that terribly close.
Not all that terribly close. And you know, certainly we would like to have not gotten as close as we did. Mm-hmm. But we did get good conservation efforts from the people of California. Businesses, state buildings were cooperating on voluntary levels. And then to have these, we call them interruptible customers, kind of in our pocket as another tool we can draw when needed, certainly that's helpful.
Okay. Why was the system stressed, though? Partly, obviously, because of the weather, but is there just not enough power being generated, or are the transmission lines overwhelmed?
Well, it's a combination of both. We would never say we just need more generation or we just need more transmission infrastructure. California could use a little bit more of both, frankly. But you can't underestimate the extreme nature of the heat storm that we came through. You know, they're calling this a 1-in-50-year event in California. Which jives quite well. I'm 46 years old, a California native, and I've never seen heat like that. So it was really a very intense heat wave that we've just come through.
We're still suffering through now. As I understand it, though, California in the last 5 years, partly as a result of what happened 5 years ago, did build a bunch of new power plants.
We have added something on the order of about 13,000 megawatts worth of new power plants in California. That's a lot. Our total demand last Monday was about 50,000 megawatts, so 13,000 is significant. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, approximately 5,000 or 6,000 megawatts, you're taxing my memory a little bit, of old power plants have dropped offline. So at the same time we're building new ones, some old ones are being mothballed or shuttered. They're no longer efficient. They're more polluting. So they're closed. So the net increase is still quite a bit, but we're really just barely keeping pace with load growth here.
And how much is that load growth growing? Is people still moving to California?
Well, people are still moving to California, and obviously there's some economic growth as well that's fueling some of this additional demand for energy. We're certainly glad to see that, but it does mean more electricity is being used. The other thing we're seeing here, Neil, is a demographic trend where more and more people are moving into the Central Valley here in Northern California, the Southern California, inland areas as well, the Inland Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So those are areas where it's much hotter than it is along the coast. Air conditioning is much more in demand. So we're seeing a kind of an overall growth in the base demand for energy at all times of the year. But the peak demand for energy is growing a little bit faster because that's driven by air conditioning and this demographic trend towards the middle of the state.
Now, we also hear about demand generated by all of the electronics that so many of us are, even more than 5 years ago, that so many of us have. And so many of those electronics, they're instant on, which means they're draining power even when they're off.
Correct. And that is a factor, certainly. You know, nobody had two or three computers at home, PDAs, cell phones, all those things are plugged in. And some of those, the transformers that charge those devices may be drawing power even when the device isn't plugged in being recharged. That adds up, certainly. It is offset to some degree in California. We have very strict new building standards, and that applies even to remodels that may be done. So the energy efficiency in most homes is far greater. It's hard to know which is greater, this new demand from all these devices or the energy efficiency gains we're making through building codes and more efficient appliances. Maybe roughly offset, but I'm not sure that any factual studies have been done on that.
We're also asking you to join this conversation if you'd like. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And we'll begin with Paul. Paul calling us from Muskegon in Michigan.
Yes. Something that I would comment on is it seems like the government needs to put a halt to a lot of this new construction of homes and businesses and whatnot, because in so many places, the grid can't handle what's already been built, and it further exacerbates this problem of blackouts and brownouts. And, why would you let someone build 100,000 new homes in a state if the grid can't support what's there now? And, just add some realism to this, where people just keep building and building and building. I mean, aside from the other issues.
Greg Fishman, should development depend on electrical grid growth?
Boy, that's a question for policymakers, and I'm not sure that anybody's going to be willing to say no more growth until. What I think we do need to do is address the other side of the equation, and how do we get more electrical infrastructure built a little bit more quickly? How do we ensure that there's going to be some cost recovery for the companies that invest in those infrastructure projects? Can we make sure that environmental rules and regulations are still being followed, but perhaps speed the process a little bit? Those kinds of things, I think, need to happen if we're going to see continued growth like we have, at least certainly here in California.
Paul, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And let's get a question in from Felipe. Felipe calling us from Laramie in Wyoming.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I was just curious what's being done to further diversify the grid down there with wind turbines and solar arrays for individual homes and stuff like that.
Is alternative generation a big factor in California?
It is, and it's growing. Neil, California is one of about, I think, 17 or 18 states around the country that has a renewable portfolio standard. At least that's what we're calling it here. It goes by other names elsewhere. And it's a requirement that X amount of power come from renewable resources by a certain time frame. Here in California, we're going to be required to have 20% of the power that's being consumed in the state come from renewable resources by the year 2010. So that's fast approaching. We have an awful lot of wind power here already. There is more being built. We certainly support solar as well, although that's typically the smaller rooftop measures that homeowners can put on their own homes or businesses as well. It is a growing trend in California, certainly, elsewhere in the nation as well. The wind turbine technology specifically has improved vastly over the last decade or so. So it's much more efficient, much more reliable. The only problem with the wind is it doesn't always blow when you need it to, and it doesn't always blow where you need it to. So it's not completely the answer to the problem. But I think the caller, Felipe, hit on something that we do need to develop more, and that is a diversified portfolio of generation types. Wind, solar, gas-fired, which we have a lot of here in California, hydroelectric where it's possible. That diversified portfolio really helps.
Felipe, thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
And just a couple of minutes with you left, I did want to say that ask about there was a spurt of power plant construction after that problem 5 years ago, but as I understand it, it has slowed down considerably.
It has for the past couple of years. I think a lot of the companies, again, that were building power plants are now in the position where they wanted to see contractual arrangements for the output of that power. So they're guaranteed that the $300 or $400 million they're investing in a new power plant in California is going to return to them. We are seeing that now. The California Public Utilities Commission recently passed a measure that we call resource adequacy, and essentially it tells the utilities and other entities that are serving demand in California that you must go out and contract for actually 115% of your expected demand over the course of a year. That extra 15% is a planning reserve margin. So we know that even if a power plant is broken or some other problem exists, that there's enough power to go around. That arrangement, that requirement from the Public Utilities Commission is now the impetus behind, I think, a renewed vigor in power plant growth in California. Again, those development companies now have some greater degree of certainty via the contractual arrangements that they'll get a return on their investment.
And quickly, you mentioned a natural gas-fired plants, petroleum-fired plants. The prices of those have both gone up. People in for a sticker shock when they open their bills next month?
Well, California's retail rates are still greatly regulated, so the rate should not change much, although some utilities do have a summer rate versus a winter rate. Mm-hmm. They also have a tiered rate structure, so the more you use, the higher you're going to pay, and I'm sure that some people will be seeing a higher bill at the end of the month than they're expecting.
Greg Fishman, thanks very much. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Greg Fishman, spokesman for the California System Operator. He joined us from member station KXJZ in Sacramento. When we come back from the break, we'll continue our conversation about what's up with the grid 3 years after the big blackout, 5 years after rolling blackouts in California. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With temperatures near or over 100 degrees in a lot of places this week, people have cranked up their air conditioning and put a lot of strain on the electrical power grids. Outages hit tens of thousands this week. Today, we're talking about the reliability of that grid, if it can keep up with the surge of demand. And joining us now is Clark Gellings. He's Vice President of Power Delivery and Markets at the Electric Power Research Institute, a nonprofit research organization that's sponsored by the nation's utilities. And he joins us from the studios of Stanford Video at Stanford University. Nice to have you on the program today.
My pleasure, indeed.
We were just hearing a little bit about California. Nationwide, how is the grid holding up?
Gee, I'm really impressed with how well the utilities and the system operators have come together in this amazing heat wave that's not just localized, as you suggested. We've got 21 states that had temperatures over 100 degrees last week, and at least seven regions of the 19 of the country electrically that have had excess demand way beyond anything they expected.
And with that demand up, part of the problem, as I understand it, is that if you build capacity for peak demand, for the records like we're setting today, come the fall, come the winter, you're going to have a lot of excess capacity.
Yeah, that's a challenge for a power engineer, and that is how to properly size the equipment, considering such as extreme temperatures, even regarding the environment where that piece of equipment must sit. We make choices about that. We always allow some reserve. The question is how much reserve to completely make the system so strong and so hard, you'd end up with a system that would be so expensive that you and I as consumers wouldn't be able to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. 3 years ago, when the big blackout happened in the northeast parts of the Midwest, the attention focused on the state of the power grid and found that much of it simply wasn't robust enough to handle modern-day demand. What has happened since then?
It's been a number of things. I I think it's notable that the industry came together literally within hours after that blackout and started to investigate and study the actions that needed to be taken. Some of them are rather mundane operational, like making sure that we trim trees, in fact, coming out with a standard which everyone needs to follow to trim trees. And some of them are more fundamental, like being sure that operators are properly trained. And surprisingly, Neil, that wasn't done in every case, although in some, of course, it was. Mm-hmm. And then I think the biggest thing the industry did was to encourage the formation of this new electric reliability organization that Congress authorized last week, I believe, and to promulgate rules for themselves, which will be held enforceable and will have teeth in them. That is, this new organization can actually fine a utility that doesn't follow certain operating guidelines. Hmm. So the biggest thing we've done is to change the way we operate the grid.
And also, has new construction been a big part of it?
No, not as much as we'd like. In fact, in the last 5 years, demand for electricity has grown on average about 1.7% per year, and new construction only about 0.5%. Now, the good news there is, though, as we look forward, more and more utilities are reporting that they see the need to increase capacity and to make additional investments. In partial, perhaps, response, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission this week approved a new act which would kind of pave the way for a special incentive for utilities who decide to invest in critical transmission corridors.
Let's get another caller in. This is Megan. Megan calling from Palo Alto in California.
Yes, hi. The question I have is in regards to the individual use. And is there a reason as individuals we are not asked to cut back? I know they have days where they ask you not to use your power at certain times, but it would seem when I hear this gentleman and the gentleman before speak about adding, you know, that we have an increase in power and building more power plants, it feels that this is going to be going on for a long time. And wouldn't it be better if we as consumers kind of came together and changed the way we're living, which I don't think would take a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I sure agree with you, Megan. I think there's so much that can be done. Here we are buying plasma screen TVs, at least some of us, that have a demand 3 or 4 times greater than a conventional colored television. Here we are increasingly putting more and more air conditioning in our homes and operating it, so that the home is colder than it was, in years gone by. It seems to me that we don't get it collectively as a society. We seem to revel in our comfort and not worry about the consequences of that.
Megan, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Another way to do this might be to incentivize conservation. Joining us now is Severin Borenstein, director of the University of California Energy Institute, professor at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, and he's been thinking about ways to do that. And, Professor, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, your idea centers around something called real-time pricing. Explain that briefly, if you would.
Well, it certainly isn't my idea. This is something that's been around the energy industry for a long time, and that is to have prices vary with the load on the system so that when the grid is very tight and you really need some conservation, charge higher prices to users, and alternatively, at times when there is plenty of power, lower the prices. This wouldn't change the average prices. If anything, it would lower them slightly overall, but it would give people a strong incentive to conserve on these hot days. And in fact, this is already being used in some states for large industrial customers, which is certainly the place to start, to give them an incentive. This morning, Mayor Bloomberg announced that some of the decorative outdoor lighting in New York City would be turned off today, mm-hmm. which seems like a pretty obvious thing to be doing. And those were individually negotiated, apparently, whereas if we had a system that charged higher prices on these hot days, lots of companies would have an incentive without Mayor Bloomberg calling them to make these sorts of adjustments.
And would this apply to residential customers as well?
Well, certainly you'd start with large industrial and commercial customers because the meters are already in. Eventually, I think we could get to residential customers. We would want to have a special program to protect the low-income consumers so that it doesn't cause a particular impact on them. But for large for the rest of us, yeah, on the hottest day of the year, giving us an economic incentive to reset our air conditioner from 74 degrees to 76 or 78 I think would be a good idea. It would certainly be more effective than what we saw in California last week and what we're seeing in New York now, which is these pleas over the radio saying, please turn your air conditioner to a higher setting for the good of the people. You know, in every other area of the economy, we recognize that economic incentives get people to take more action. I think this is one of the areas we need to do it.
Is this being tried anywhere?
Oh, yeah. This has been adopted. In fact, Georgia Power has been running a real-time pricing program for large industrial customers for 15 years. Gulf Power in Florida has a program on the residential side. New York has recently adopted Niagara Mohawk, a program for large industrial customers. Chicago, they are trying a program for residential customers. California has grudgingly been moving in this direction for 5 years now, but it has been painfully slow. We've run a pilot program that has shown that customers will conserve and will conserve more on those peak days if you raise prices on those peak days. And remember, this isn't raising prices overall, so the bill impact would be fairly small, but you could save a lot of money on the hottest day of the year if you're willing to make fairly small adjustments, being careful about the lights, where you leave the lights on, not running the dishwasher, changing your air conditioning settings, things like that.
Even unplugging that plasma TV for a little while. Clark Gellings.
Even unplugging.
Clark Gellings.
That's right.
Is this a good idea from your point of view?
Oh, it absolutely is. I'd like to piggyback on that and suggest that while we're doing that, I want to find a way to incent people to actually just buy more efficient appliances and devices. California, the state of California, has been a leader in that regard. I'm not sure that most people are aware that the per capita energy consumption in the state of California is flat since 1973 because of aggressive measures regarding building codes, efficiency standards, and programs that the utilities are encouraged to administer that helps people conserve energy. I'd like to see those extended to the nation.
Mm. Let's get another caller in. This is Bern. Bern's calling us from Little Rock in Arkansas.
I'm in Arkansas, I guess, as you already said.
And
we have a number of hydroelectric plants, a couple of nuclear plants. years ago, we were forced to pay an excise tax for Grand Gulf. I'm just wondering, I mean, I live in a state that has an abundant amount of, natural, well, not really natural, since it's nuclear, I guess, but you know what I'm saying.
You have a lot of power plants.
Right, but we have just had an increase in our utility rate, at least with energy anyway, it was originally going to be $9 on the 100. It realistically turned into $15 on the 100, $100 on your bill.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, how is it that, we're talking about all these alternative power supplies. I live in a state that has an abundance of them up and down the Arkansas River, but yet we still get hit with increases in energy. I don't understand. I thought the Corps of Engineers maintains them, but do they themselves sell the power to the power companies, or...
Well, let's get a response from Clark Gellings. Is Burns' experience localized, or is this a national thing, or is this simply the price of oil?
I'm afraid that it's not the price of oil, although the price of oil influences immediately the price of natural gas. To the extent there's any natural gas generation mix in Entergy's portfolio, that's going to ratchet up significantly. To the extent that they have a heavy construction burden as a result of the hurricanes that occurred there last summer, that has to be borne, unfortunately, in general, by the ratepayers. There's a lot of pressure on utilities, a lot of pressure both financially and regarding their workforces. 60% of the 400,000 utility workers in this nation will retire in the next 5 years. The need for new training programs, bringing on new staff, it's a portfolio of pressures that I certainly wouldn't want to be part of if I didn't have to be.
Well, just speaking on behalf of your customers, there's a lot of pressure on us, too.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay. Bern, thanks very much for the call.
Well, thank you. Y'all have a good day.
All right. Good luck with your next bill. Before we let you go, Severin Borenstein, this real-time pricing idea, would anybody be hurt by it?
Well, there are some customers who would end up paying more because they're using a lot of power at peak times. And right now they're being subsidized by the system that charges you the same price, whether it's the middle of the day when wholesale prices are through the roof or the middle of the night when they're very low. I think that for the low-income consumers who might be hurt, it certainly makes sense to have programs to protect them. But for the rest of us and the large corporations and commercial companies that would pay more, I think that's just facing up to the real cost of electricity. And that's likely to become a more important issue going forward. One of your guests said that this was a 1-in-50-year event that we've had over the last few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually a 1-in-50-year event looking backwards. Looking forwards, it's not clear at all that this is going to be a 1-in-50-year event. This might not be part of global climate change, but it certainly might be. And we might be seeing more of these real stresses on the system. Balancing the system by having everybody conserve a little, as real-time pricing would give people incentive to do, makes a lot more sense than balancing it by blacking out some people so that they have no power at all.
Severin Borenstein, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Professor Borenstein, director of the UC Energy Institute and professor at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. And he joined us today from the studios at the University of California at Berkeley. Clark Gellings, we thank you for your time today as well.
Thank you.
Clark Gellings is Vice President of Power Delivery and Markets at the Electric Power Institute, EPRI, which is a nonprofit research organization sponsored by the nation's utilities. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.